This is Law and Disorder. A million people were hired this year, temporary workers, to help with the 2010 census. How were they hired? Their names were run through an FBI check before they got the job. And what happened as a result? Well, you'll hear what happened and the lawsuit that ensued because people of color were discriminated against. Since 9/11, there's been much concern about the long arm of the FBI reaching into peace groups, anti-war groups. It should come as no surprise that even the FBI's own internal investigative agency, groups engaging in all kinds of protest, even very mild civil disobedience, are now tarred with the terrorism brush. Informants are sent into their midst. First Amendment activities are monitored. This is not just Law and Disorder talking. This is the Office of the Inspector General of the FBI.
Stay with us.
On and off for a few days now, I've seen small references to a story about United States arms sales to Saudi Arabia. Now, of course, that's been going on forever. We've been supporting the Saudi dictatorship forever. But this one caught my eye, and it hasn't really received much attention, but it says that the Obama administration is seeking to sell Saudi Arabia $60 billion worth of advanced aircraft. Hear that again, $60 billion worth of advanced aircraft. 84 new F-15 fighter jets, 70 Apache helicopters, 72 Black Hawk helicopters, 36 Little Bird helicopters. Other than the size, which would make it the U.S.'s biggest foreign arms deal ever, the other thing that struck me about this piece was $60 billion. It's essentially the Obama administration giving $60 billion to Al-Qaeda. Now, that may sound surprising. He's not giving it to Al-Qaeda. The Obama administration is giving it to Saudi Arabia. But think about it. When the World Trade Center was attacked by Al-Qaeda, one of its main public issues that it stated was U.S. troops in Saudi Arabia, all of the people on the airplanes, every single one, the 17, were all from Saudi Arabia. What the U.S. has done is created, supported a dictatorship in Saudi Arabia. They haven't had an election forever, as far as I know. A dictatorship. It's wiped out any semblance of democracy there. And as a result, the resistance to Saudi Arabia is coming from the far right, from the religious right, whatever you want to call it. And here the U.S. is now supporting that very regime that has been creating, in my view, creating, whether directly or indirectly, the very forces that this administration claims it is fighting throughout the world, Al-Qaeda. It's almost illogical. It's nonsensical to me. $60 billion to Saudi Arabia, one of the worst dictatorships we have. If you had to look at a core of the creation of terrorism in this world, it's our support for Saudi Arabia. But no outcry, yet we continue to pour billions in wars, ostensibly, to get rid of Al-Qaeda, while at the same time, $60 billion to Saudi Arabia. That brings me to another story. That brings me to another story, which was also a shock. Even those of us who follow the wars in Afghanistan, follow the wars in Iraq, follow the wars in Africa and Yemen and around the world, while we don't accept the fact that the United States has claimed that it's really fighting Al-Qaeda and making us safe from terrorism, you know, we always think, well, maybe there's something there, maybe there's a little bit there. But then all of a sudden you read this report. It comes out of an organization called the International Institute for Strategic Studies. Let me say it again, International Institute for Strategic Studies. It's the world's leading think tank for military affairs. It's London-based and represents the top echelon of defense experts, considered very, very moderate, authoritative, cautious, diplomatic. All of a sudden, you're seeing this think tank issue a report saying that the threat from Al-Qaeda and the Taliban has, quote, been exaggerated by the Western powers, and that the U.S.-led mission in Afghanistan has, quote, ballooned out of proportion from its original purpose of defeating Al-Qaeda. And in blunt language, it said that the war is a long, drawn-out disaster. That report was directed by a former deputy of Britain's Foreign Intelligence Agency, MI6. That is the man who is saying that the U.S. and other countries have utterly exaggerated the threat. So think about it. Here we are fighting all over the world to supposedly stop Al-Qaeda, which is going to come and kill us, according to President Obama and others. And here are the very think tank, the most prominent in the world, presided over by a former British intelligence head, says the threat is completely exaggerated. Put that together with the $60 billion we're putting into Saudi Arabia, that's going to create a worse situation. And you have to say, the entire thing we're seeing right now, the war, etc., is a complete fraud. The one thing I should say, it's a complete fraud, but at the same time, the $60 billion to Saudi Arabia are apparently going to create 75,000 jobs in the United States, 75,000 jobs from such companies as Boeing, Lockheed Martin, and United Technologies. If there was ever a country that's completely out of control and carrying out wars that are completely merciless and unjustified, sadly, it's now the United States. Earlier this year, thousands of people of color who applied for work with the 2010 census were deemed ineligible or deterred from the application process. The Center for Constitutional Rights and its co-counsel, Outen and Golden, and others filed a federal lawsuit in the Southern District of New York against the Census Bureau for race and national origin discrimination in the hiring of temporary workers. The case, Johnson v. Locke, claims that the U.S. Census Bureau's practice of running job applicants' names through the 70 million records of the FBI database, a notoriously inaccurate and complete arrest database, disproportionately excludes applicants of color and deters them from completing the application process. Essentially, anyone with an arrest will not be eligible, no matter how minor the arrest, and even if the arrests result in neither prosecution nor conviction. This practice directly undermines the Census Bureau's self-avowed commitment to hiring temporary workers from within historically undercounted communities, such as low-income people of color and immigrants. African Americans, Latinos, and Native Americans are subject to exceedingly disproportionate rates of contact with the criminal justice system, from disparate rates of stop and frisks and arrests to higher conviction rates and harsher criminal penalties. For this reason, among many others, using the FBI 70 million record database has a direct and indirect effect of discriminating against people of color. To get an update on this case, we're joined in the studio by lead attorney Sam Miller of the law firm Outen and Golden. Sam, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks. Pleasure to be here, Michael.
Sam, we have covered this case a bit before. This is the lawsuit against the Census Bureau for its method of hiring for the 2010 census. So give us a lay of the land. In 2010, we had the decennial census. They hired a million people. And then you are the lead lawyer in some kind of lawsuit against the census around race and national origin discrimination. What's that about?
That's correct, Michael. I'm one of the litigators on a class action lawsuit against the Census Bureau based on its hiring practices for folks who were going to be doing the actual counting process, those who would be out going door to door and also those who would be serving as clerks in offices to manage the count for the 2010, what they call the decennial census. The real unfortunate feature here and somewhat the irony is that Census is the government agency that is in charge of not just counting people numerically, but also for particular purposes. And those include tracking people by race and ethnicity and other features that have a major impact on how federal government money gets spent and how representation is attributed in terms of political representation. While Census is responsible for those major features of our democracy, when it comes to hiring people to do that work and engaged in the most rudimentary errors and discrimination in terms of bringing people in to take on those jobs, and it did so at a scale that is really enormous.
Yeah, let's talk about that. There's a million people hired for census or something like that?
Over a million people hired. So
for how long a period did they get hired?
Well, they generally work for 6 to 8 weeks. Some work longer than that, but that's generally the period. Now, one might say, well, that's not a very long period of time. But especially in this economy with massive unemployment and people struggling day to day to meet their rent or mortgage payments to put food on the table, a couple months worth of steady work at good wages, we're talking $13 to upwards of $20 an hour, really makes a difference. And it would have made a difference for a lot of people who should have been hired, who didn't, based on discriminatory hiring.
What kind of discriminatory hiring method?
Well, the crux of it is that Census Bureau eliminates virtually everybody who's ever been arrested in their life. So they call it a criminal background check process. I think most people and most of your listeners, I'm sure, when they think about criminal background, they think about people with significant convictions. We don't think about people who've been arrested and who have been let go, who have never been prosecuted. And I'm sure that many of your listeners out there have had an arrest at some point in their life. And it would come as a great surprise to them if they applied for a job and they were told, well, you've been arrested at some point, so you're going to be treated differently than folks who have no arrest.
Have you ever been arrested?
I actually have been arrested.
What were you arrested for, if I may ask?
I was arrested for civil disobedience.
Right.
A couple times in my life. And if I were to go to Census and apply for a job, and they were to send me a letter, which is what they do, if I were to get a letter saying, your name popped up in the FBI database, and you have to go get an original or an official court record of your arrest. We're not going to tell you what you're arrested for, when it occurred, or why we care about it. Your name popped up, and you have to go get your official court records. And if you can't do it, you're out.
So, for example, in your case, where were you arrested?
This is getting personal, Mike.
No, but what court? Okay. I don't care about
In the 80s, I was involved in a protest with a group called CISPIS, which I'm sure you're familiar with, the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador. The whole group of us was arrested and cited out and let go.
What city?
This was in San Francisco.
Yeah, so I had a similar arrest in the 80s in New York City.
Sure.
Hundreds of us were arrested. And then we were put in jail for a short while or whatever and let out afterwards. I don't even remember whether I got pleaded to a violation. I don't remember anything. But you're saying I would get it, or if we were applying for a census job, no, they would check the FBI database. Your name would come up. My name would come up. But, of course, we're sitting here as white North Americans, so it's not really the example, the perfect example.
That's
but
right.
We'll go there in a second. But our names come up. Do they tell us what court the arrest is in?
No. They tell you absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. You get a form letter.
Here, you and I are lawyers.
That's right.
You get a form letter that says what?
You get a form letter that says your name was flagged in the FBI database as having some criminal record.
Which has 70 million names in it, right?
More than that.
Okay.
Just as an aside, but a very important one, roughly one quarter of the entire U.S. adult population has a record in the FBI database.
Wow.
Which for the civil libertarians out in your audience, if they don't know that already, I think, should be very shocking. And it certainly was shocking to me.
That's like almost 100 million people, 80 million
people. It is a massive number of people who have a record in the FBI database. And the FBI database is very flawed. It has an enormous number of errors in it. And it includes things that people would assume would not be there. For instance, an arrest where there's never been a prosecution. It includes expungements. It includes juvenile records in some instances.
I remember I had an expungement. I was busted on a marijuana something when I was in law school. It wasn't even me. It was somebody down the in the same apartment. And, of course, when I went into court, I was a law student, and I was arrested, and they expunged any record of it.
Right. And you think that that record has disappeared, but it has not necessarily disappeared. It may be sitting there with the FBI. One of the problems with this process is that the older your arrest, the less significant it is in terms of the nature of the offense, the harder it's going to be to go get that official court record.
It couldn't be done probably in my case, 1968.
Right. You have 30 days to do it. And if you can't do it in 30 days, you're out.
We're lawyers and it couldn't be done.
That's right. Let me just give you a different example to depersonalize it a little bit from ourselves, which is one of the named plaintiffs in our case. Her name is Precious Daniels. She lives in Detroit. She's an African-American woman who has a steady employment record. She works in the healthcare industry. She's a phlebotomist, takes people's blood. She was very upset about healthcare policy in the United States, and she organized a small protest in front of Blue Cross, peaceful protest, and she was arrested. She went to court. The police officer didn't show up, and the charge was dropped. Classic, typical situation, happens all the time. She went into the FBI database because she had been fingerprinted. She goes to apply for the census because she's between work, needs the income, and her name pops up in the FBI database. The census sends us this letter, and she says, I'm trying to figure out what they're talking about. What criminal record do I have?
Amazing.
And she can't comply. And she then gets a rejection letter. It's a form letter, but you are rejected from consideration to be an enumerator, is what they call the folks who go out door to door, or a clerk, or take any other temporary position with the Census Bureau. And that example is emblematic of tens and even hundreds of thousands of people across the country who tried to do their civic duty, make a little extra cash, put food on the table, were told by the U.S. government that you're not going to even be considered. You know, if this was—
Now, where does race and origin, national origin, come into this? Because obviously you and I may well be in those records as well. We're not—
That's right.
We're not being discriminated on basis of our race particularly. But.
That's exactly right. The way it comes in is that this is a what we call a disparate impact lawsuit. It is different than what we call a disparate treatment lawsuit, where intentional discrimination is being alleged. In this kind of case, the challenge to the policy is that you have a policy. Here it's checking people's criminal background and excluding them on the basis of that background. The discrimination occurs because of the enormous disparity that's in the criminal justice process. So we know that in terms of arrest, conviction, incarceration, all the features of criminal justice and punishment in the country heavily disproportionately impact African Americans, Latinos, and Native Americans. So when you have an employment practice that uses criminal history, especially in a blanket or an across-the-board way, to exclude people from jobs, then you just import the disparities from criminal justice right into the employment context.
This is a huge problem, obviously, in the country in general. But in this particular case, it meant a lot of people lost jobs.
Right. I mean, I believe this is the largest employment discrimination case for many years. I mean, we're talking about 700,000 people were excluded from these jobs just on the basis of this form letter that went out.
I can't believe 700,000?
700,000.
Because their name was in the database, and they got a letter saying you have an arrest or something in our database, and they never got something back to the Census Department in 30 days.
That's right. And they were completely, at that point, they were completely excluded from the process. So we know that well over 100,000 African Americans and Latinos and Native Americans are in that group of people that were just automatically excluded right off the bat.
So what are you doing about it?
Sue them.
My census has been taken already. I don't know about yours. I mean, sued them. You sued them. When did you sue them? The census started in April.
The hiring started well before then.
Right.
This information came to us pretty much during the spring of 2010. And we got the litigation underway as fast as we could, which was that we filed the suit originally in April, mid-April of 2010. We recently amended the complaint because we found out some very important information during the intervening time. What we're looking for now is to change their policy and practices. It's not going to be in time for most of the work for the 2010 census. It's been done. The count has happened. And the hiring has almost entirely been completed. So unfortunately, it's too late to really affect the hiring for the 2010 census. But the census is constantly doing work. They update the census. They have all kinds of other reports. If you pick up the paper pretty much any day, there's going to be some article that relies on Census Bureau analysis and data. And so there's future hiring, and of course there's into the distant future, there's the next decennial census. But the larger point is that the census is one bureau within one agency within the federal government. My concern is that it is just the tip of the iceberg, that there is a broader problem in the federal government
I want to go there in 1 second, Sam, but sure. First, I just want to finish one or two last questions about this. What remedy are you asking for in the lawsuit? That they should not use arrest records at all? That people should get damages? What's going to happen?
I see. So there's two parts of it, which you just flagged. One is they need to change their policy. They cannot deny people employment based on arrest records where there's never been a prosecution, there's never been a conviction. It's just we're innocent until proven guilty, and somebody with an arrest record where it's never gone further than that should be treated the same as somebody without an arrest record. In New York State, there's actually a statute that forbids the denial of employment based on an arrest without conviction. And I think that most people would agree that that is just a fundamental part of the understanding in this country of what the Constitution requires. The other part of it is damages, money damages, which of course we're asking for. So we have a class of over 100,000 people that should be compensated for the jobs that they should have gotten, for which they were wrongfully denied. For the time period that they would have been working, they should be paid the wages that they would have earned. And that will be a very large number that we'll get to towards the end of the case. But right now, our analysis of it is that we are into the hundreds of millions of dollars that the U.S. Census Bureau is going to owe people in this lawsuit because of this outrageous policy.
Last question. What's possible about this issue? And then I want to go to the broader issue. What's the defense of the Census Department? I mean, it sounds like a slam dunk case in a way. I mean, it's crazy.
I honestly don't see a defense. I have cases. At Alton & Golden, the firm where I work at, we have a lot of discrimination cases. We specialize in this area. We have other cases where even if I disagree, I can at least see the defense. Here, I started off from the point when the first few clients started coming to us, I thought, this looks like bureaucracy in action. It looks like just somebody within a bureaucracy came up with a policy that did not get vetted very well, where it just never went through an individual who saw and cared to take the time to say, hey, wait a minute, this is going to result in enormous racial discrimination. You can't do this. That's what I first expected. But we kept seeing people come in. And then we filed a lawsuit, and then we got some discovery. I took some depositions. There's still a lot more to go, but we learned some very important things very early on. And one of the most important is that they did it the same way 10 years ago.
I read that in your papers, and what fascinated me when you said this was unintentional discrimination,
well,
you said it was by impact and, you know, essentially inadvertent in a way. But if they did it before and they knew the results, you could make an argument that it was that this is done intentionally. You've done it once, here's the effects, and now you've done it again.
Well, you know, lawsuits have lives of their own. And we started the lawsuit by saying it's a disparate impact case because what we were seeing was a policy that wasn't intentionally discriminatory on its face, and it was having a huge discriminatory impact. So that's the legal box that we put it in. But as we learn more information, it certainly is looking more and more like a policy where they knew what they were doing. So they did it this way in 2000. They knew that 10 years later, if they adopted the same policy, that they were going to have the same effect. And in fact, they staffed their offices in order to review a very small number of people who were able to respond to this form letter. So they knew that in 2000, roughly 93% of the people were unable to reply to that letter. And so they staffed their offices in 2010 with the same expectation.
Now, you were alluding a moment ago to the broader impact of this. And, I, you know, just from a little bit we've covered on this show at various times, you put your finger on a key issue of the way records like that are used to discriminate broadly in the country, not just at the census. So give us a little talk about that as well.
Sure. I mean, I think there's a growing awareness in the country that criminal background, whether it's just an arrest or a plea bargain or a conviction, has consequences that extend for years and even decades beyond the time that either the arrest is not prosecuted or after the jail time or prison time is finished. And so there's a growing awareness, and there's more attention being paid to what some people call the collateral consequences of criminal history. Now, public defenders and other legal aid and defender groups are focusing on this in terms of getting appropriate representation and advice to criminal defendants before they plead and before they go through a trial, so that they understand if you plead out now in order to get home within 30 days, this may really have an impact on you. So if you're going to plead to something you didn't do, just because the prosecutor or somebody else is telling you, well, it's the easiest way to get home fast, you need to really think, you need to at least understand that there are consequences down the road in terms of getting public housing, in terms of employment and other in other areas where it could really come back to bite you. So that's one focus that folks are having on it. I think beyond that, government employers and private employers are taking more notice of how these policies are having an impact on applicants for employment.
But isn't it pretty standard to ask a private employer to ask, or a public one, have you ever been arrested? And don't they oftentimes have access to some kind of database, if not the FBI database, to see and check whether you've been arrested?
Well, the standard question often is and should be, if they're asking it at all, whether there's been a conviction. The question should not be whether there's been an arrest, because that's irrelevant. Now, when the question is, have you ever been convicted, then the response of the company needs to be an individualized determination as to whether any convictions are job relevant. In other words, what was the conviction for, and what's the kind of job that you have? How long ago did the conviction happen, and what's your history since you were convicted or released from prison or jail? So somebody who has a conviction, but it was 10 years ago, it was a minor offense, and they're now applying for a job stocking shelves at the local big box store, there's no job relevance to their conviction, and they shouldn't be excluded from hire based on that. Now, of course, there are going to be convictions that are very serious, that are related to the job, that are recent, where an employer ought to be able to consider the conviction and, in some instances, deny employment based on it. But it has to be on an individualized review, and it has to be on an analysis that really looks at job relevance.
What's fascinating, as you opened this, you talked about discrimination within our criminal justice system and how that then just really spreads out. And that's really what's going on here.
That's exactly right. And it is in government and it is in private employment across the board. And there are major government agencies and private employers that are engaged in systemic discrimination based on these criminal background checks. And it's an area that we're trying to bring more public awareness to through the litigation, that there are advocacy groups that are trying to bring more public awareness to it. But it's very important the people making these decisions understand the effect of looking at criminal background and how racial discrimination results if they don't do it in a way that's individualized and that makes sense in terms of relating the job to whatever the conviction was. There are employers out there for sure who have good human resources departments and practices, who know how to do this and they do it properly. But it is an area where a lot of employers are way behind and need to become educated and need to drastically revise the way that they do this part of their hiring process.
Where do we expect to be a year from now? I mean, when is the census case going to be over? Or I know you can't necessarily predict that, but what do you see as the timetable?
My hope is that the word about how completely outrageous census's policy is gets up to a high enough level in the government, whether it's the Secretary of Commerce or the White House or wherever it needs to go, that the word gets there, and that that folks in decision-making power understand the enormous discrimination that has occurred, and that they will then take action by trying to resolve the lawsuit and by changing policy, not only in census, but really looking across the federal government. And changing the way that the federal government looks at criminal background. And I should add that credit history is also a very significant issue that's related and parallel to criminal history, because there is also racial disparity in terms of credit rating. And many employers are using credit history to exclude people from employment.
So tell me about that a little bit. What is, sure. I understand what credit history is, but where do you see the racial discrimination in that?
Racial discrimination in terms of who gets negative credit ratings, in terms of the numerical difference between African Americans and Latinos, in terms of the way that the credit agencies rate individuals, and there's disparities just in terms of the way that credit is both given and taken away. And we saw that certainly with the mortgage debacle and the way that banks were discriminating in terms of giving these low-rate mortgages that were going to then explode on people, and how they were actually targeting communities of color with those kinds of mortgage practices.
I mean, I don't know how to say this. I mean, this is obviously a huge problem. It's been a problem for a very long time. I don't know if you looked at, did you ever read Michelle Alexander's new book, The New Jim Crow?
Sure.
So, I mean, this is really, I mean, you're hitting the core that what really we've created is essentially a permanent underclass, and we don't have overt Jim Crow laws, but we essentially have done a similar thing. I mean,
that's exactly right. Michelle has part of a chapter of her book is devoted to the looking at criminal history and the way that it these collateral consequences of convictions and arrests occur. And she mentions some of the studies that undergird our lawsuits on the criminal history issue. It is a major issue in terms of social justice, because it is, as Michelle points out, furthering this undercast of individuals who are unable or have very great difficulty in finding employment, you know, based on criminal history that in many instances is racially biased and that is following them for years and decades. And it's not just the individuals, but it's affecting their families, it's affecting their communities.
Well, thank you very much, Sam, and thank you, Outen and Golden, and all of your other allies. I know you have my office, or your former office, the Center for Constitutional Rights, which you came to for a little bit of assistance, so we really appreciate it.
Well, it's a pleasure being here, Michael. Thank you for having me on.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Last year, we've reported on the FBI's overreaching authority in cases that profile Muslims and the use of informants to entrap people on terrorism charges. Now, in a report released by the Justice Department, the FBI is exposed for inappropriately targeting left-leaning groups after 9/11. Among those groups targeted, the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, Greenpeace, and the Catholic Worker. In a four-year internal investigation of one event that the FBI had targeted, the OIG report, quote, found no evidence that the FBI had any information at the time of the event that any terrorism suspect would be present at the event, end quote. There are many other similar examples. The OIG report concluded that FBI Director Robert Mueller, quote, had unintentionally provided inaccurate testimony to Congress, end quote, regarding the 2006 anti-war rally in Pittsburgh 4 years earlier. To talk more about the OIG investigative report, we're joined by attorney Thomas Cincotta, project director with Political Research Associates. Tom, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael. Good afternoon.
Tom, I was a little bit surprised or amazed to recently read, summary at least, of the review of the FBI's investigations of certain domestic advocacy groups. It's the FBI, the Office of Inspector General's report on allegations that the FBI had violated its own guidelines or the law by looking into certain groups such as Greenpeace, Catholic Worker. And I know you're an expert on this, so I want to get a sense from you of what that report is about, why it was done, and what some of its results were.
Well, this report was prompted by media reports of FBI surveillance of a number of domestic political organizations, as you mentioned, Greenpeace, several anti-war groups, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. And these reports of surveillance came to light through several Freedom of Information Act requests. And the report illustrates a really broad scope of authority that the FBI has right now and has had since this covers a period from 2001 through 2006 to open investigations about ostensibly criminal activity. But here we see the FBI really investigating activist democratic participation. And it highlights several important cases, and it's really an eye-opening and somewhat startling report that everyone should read. It sheds a lot of light on what the FBI is doing and what they are characterizing these days as terrorism.
I read the report, at least some of it, before I got on the show with you here. It's quite a shocker. Even though they try and lessen the impact by saying it's not against the law or this was inadvertent or this and this, it's a real shocker. And I think one thing you pointed out was the guidelines that they were operating under, which were the guidelines up until 2008, which I guess are the Ashcroft guidelines, I guess I would call them. But then, of course, they were made even broader, giving the FBI authority in 2008, is that right?
Right
before Obama took office, and they still are the guidelines that the FBI is operating on today. I read those new guidelines, and we don't want to talk about it abstractly, but basically allowing almost anything.
Right, and that's a real subtext in this report. The Inspector General is saying, look, under the existing guidelines, I have to say that some of these investigations, at least the opening, the decision to conduct what's called a preliminary inquiry and learn more about this group's activities, they feel that their hands are tied and have to find that it passes a very low threshold. But the undercurrent is that under the 2008 revised guidelines, under their new power to conduct assessments for potential terrorism, that all bets are off. Most of these activities from the Inspector General's report would be legal or compliant with the guidelines. I can't actually come to terms with a lot of their conclusions that many of these investigations were not based solely on First Amendment activity. Some of the facts just don't add up. There seems to be some disconnect with reality here because of who the FBI is choosing to investigate.
Yeah, give us some examples. I mean, you mentioned some of the groups.
Well, half of the report seems to deal with documents that surfaced regarding the FBI surveillance of a pacifist organization based in Pittsburgh called the Thomas Merton Center. And they focus on two key incidents. One, in 2002, an FBI agent was dispatched to observe a rally for raising awareness about the imminent attack on Iraq. This agent went to take photographs of leafletting in the park, subsequently filed a report that included information about the nature of the Thomas Merton Society, what they do politically. It had no evidence, contained no evidence of criminal activity. And the Inspector General reaches the conclusion that, one, this agent simply did this because he wasn't doing anything better at the time. It was a make-work assignment, and he wanted to impress his supervisor, and that's why he did a more full report, even though he observed nothing of note during his afternoon at the rally. What the Inspector General focuses on is a subsequent, what I think could be characterized as a cover-up by the FBI, and what the IG calls an effort to mislead about the true nature of that investigation, or what at a minimum was extraordinary carelessness by several FBI employees. Once this rally report came to light, there was a real effort, it seems, to mislead Congress and the public about what the agent was doing there that day.
Right, as I recall what they said, and this was, I agree with you on the first thing you said, which is that why, if this was just, you know, the FBI guy trying to impress his bosses and doing a good report, you know, why did the FBI focus on essentially an anti-war group to do this? I mean, what is that about?
Exactly.
Anyway, and your second point, which is the cover-up was that they had a report of there would possibly be an alleged terrorist among the demonstrators or something like that. Is that right?
Yes. There were two versions were developed, it seems, by a supervising FBI agent in that Pittsburgh field division, that one, that they were there to see if a gentleman named Farouk was present at the rally, and then later they sent him out to see if a different terrorism suspect was present. When I think they realized that actually Farouk, who passed away in 2008, was a somewhat revered community leader who had no connections to terrorism. This story seemed to be fabricated by or developed by an attorney in the office as well as the supervisor, and was later passed on to higher levels in the FBI and was used to brief Director Mueller before he appeared before Congress for an oversight hearing. And Director Mueller repeated the inaccurate and misleading spin that had been given to the event. So the IG finds that their stories just didn't add up.
It didn't add up, but of course he's strong about it, but he uses the word inadvertent, essentially, which is really a shocker. But another thing that I saw in the report, which you alluded to in the beginning, but they talk about these groups, you know, everybody from, as you said, the Thomas Merton Center, PETA, Greenpeace, Catholic Worker, the Quakers. They talk about them engaging not just in demonstrations, but also in mild civil disobedience or nonviolent civil disobedience. And one of the fears we had going in after 9/11 and with the Patriot Act and the broader definitions of domestic terrorism, which a lot of us have been focusing on since 9/11, saying, well, this use of domestic terrorism, they're going to paint and they're going to tar domestic groups who are engaged in peaceful protest as well as civil disobedience, they're going to paint them with a terrorism brush. And everybody said, no, they won't do that. That's not what this is about. And one of the things, as I recall, that happened in this report, that the FBI did, in fact, paint some of these groups as terrorist groups. Is that right?
Right. For instance, they characterized or opened a domestic terrorism investigation regarding the Pittsburgh Organizing Group, who were organizing a contingent to protest the Free Trade Area of the Americas meeting in Miami. Even after that protest, this investigation remained open. The FTAA protest took place in 2003. So in 2004, 2005, and 2006, they had an ongoing investigation with a confidential informant still placed in the Pittsburgh Organizing Group. And through this whole time, they characterized their activities as terroristic in nature because they had been associated with property damage or direct action in the past that, well, at least the FBI conflates with forceful or violent behavior. These terms, forceful and violent, aren't spelled out in FBI policy. So there's a broad and vague, there's a lot of discretion for them to slap this terrorism label on their investigations, which can be extraordinarily prejudicial to their targets.
I think that's a very strong point. In fact, as the summary of the report says, the FBI classified the matters that the report examined, which are these various groups, as domestic terrorism cases. And then the report goes on to say that this practice of the FBI classifying these matters as domestic terrorism cases did not violate the definitions of domestic terrorism in federal law, the Attorney General's guidelines, or the FBI policies. So what that says is these guidelines and laws are so broad that you can take a group like Catholic Worker, which does some protests and some civil disobedience and call it domestic terrorism. And then it goes on, and the point you just made, that this domestic terrorism classification has impact beyond even the stigma that results from the release of the documents under the FOIA that these groups are involved, they're classified as domestic terrorism cases, but that the individuals involved, once you're classified as that, let's say you're involved in civil disobedience, as many of our listeners and have been that you're then classified as falling within a group of domestic terrorism, and then there's consequences from no-fly lists, watching. I mean, all kinds of things happen once you're classified as that.
Right. To give an example on the broad definition of their terrorism, with regard to the Catholic worker, the FBI made a determination that spilling human blood on the walls and an American flag were forceful acts resulting in damage to government property. There's a complete disconnect here from a common sense notion of what terrorism is, you know, that notion of inflicting terror in a civilian population is completely absent from their equation. When a full investigation is opened under the current policy for domestic terrorism purposes, the target's name is immediately put on the violent gang terrorist offender list, the VGTOF.
Wow, I didn't know that. That's amazing.
The IG's report goes into this. So even though you haven't been accused of a crime, you're out there on this list. And that the VGTOF list is used by all of the terrorism screening centers and by the TSA and Customs Bureau. This report talks about two PETA activists who had been under an investigation, were on the task force list, and were stopped for extended delays in questioning 12 times over a two-year period during international travel. And even after their case was closed and no charges were filed, and the FBI had asked the National Counterterrorism Center to remove them from the list, these two individuals' names remained on watch lists. They remained on the TIDES list and another list. So they continued to face harassment every time they tried to travel and move freely.
The thing I can't get over about this is, you know, this, while the report, you know, as I said, pulls its punches and, as we both said, talks about stuff, but, you know, doesn't necessarily characterize it the way we would, it's still quite strong, and it verifies what we've been thinking about now for 10 or 11 years, that these broad guidelines and this, quote, unleashing of the FBI has been exactly what they've done. And it reminds me so much of in the 80s when they went after, you know, all the people doing work on Central America, the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador, all of the kinds of groups that did, you know, domestic dissent and protest. One of the things, when you mentioned the Catholic worker, is that they pick up, they even go back to their old days. The report talks about the FBI includes in its characterization of the Catholic worker, apart from all this terrorist stuff, that they're fomenting or advocating a semi-communistic ideology and a, quote, a communist distribution of resources. And so they're already going back to the old days of kicking, you know, kicking around anybody who they claim is a communist.
Right. There's this real emphasis on ideology, which is a very sloppy way, I think, of doing criminal law enforcement work. As a very predictive quality, meaning, okay, organization A has said this, espouses this in its philosophy, therefore that means we can expect that it intends to do Y. We all know there is not a straight causal line between those two points. So when they look at it, label a group anarchistic, they make an assumption that that means, based on historical evidence, that means this group will be involved in destruction of property or throwing bombs in the worst case. With the Catholic worker, I find it kind of peculiar how they pick and choose what ideological strains they're looking at. Obviously, it's an organization committed to very principled nonviolence and has never been accused of or been involved in hurting anyone. So they are kind of choosy about what ideological messages they pick up on. And of course, in other counterterrorism work, you see that mindset being deployed by the FBI. Well, they will look at terrorism suspects, for instance, Muslim religious figures who speak in a certain political manner, they will associate then with terrorism, conflating ideology with violence.
What are you, and I know you work at Political Research Associates, what are you guys thinking of doing next? I mean, now we have this report, we have these groups, we have these broad FBI guidelines that allow anything. What's next?
At PRA, we have a number of projects where we're looking at the domestic security infrastructure. Last spring, we published a report about the See Something, Say Something campaigns, which encourage people to snitch on their neighbor for taking pictures of power plants and electrical lines and tourist landmarks. Again, that's an example of where terrorism is being used to go after a wide variety of people for doing innocent behaviors. We have a report coming out this fall about private training firms drumming up Islamophobia in the ranks of police and Homeland Security intelligence analysts. With regard to these guidelines, I think this report demonstrates that we can't trust the FBI to police themselves. Their rate of compliance with their own policies and guidelines is abysmal. The IG report references a prior report where they found only 47% compliance by the FBI with its own internal checks and balances. So more than half the time, the FBI isn't following its own rules. And if Director Mueller is not doing his homework such that he can, you know, come before Senator Leahy and essentially mislead Congress, intentionally or not, it's beholden on the people then to make the FBI accountable, to put more mechanisms for public oversight and give some teeth to the rules that they're supposed to be abiding by. We need mechanisms so when people are targeted by the FBI unfairly, they can be held to account, unless they're forced to pay and be held accountable for breaking these rules. I don't see any real change in that culture occurring.
Can you give us the website of Political Research Associates where our listeners can find out more information about your work?
Thank you. Yes. Political Research Associates is found at www.publiceye.org. That's publiceye.org.
Well, thank you, and have fun at the Guild Convention.
Thank you, Mr. Ratner.
Great. Bye-bye, Tom. If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
Here comes the helicopter, second time today. Everybody scatters and hopes it goes away. How many kids they've murdered, only God can say.
before.